Hi, everyone. Welcome to Literacy Works, the Bedrock Learning podcast, where we bring really interesting people from various parts of the education sector to come and talk to us about issues that we think are really important to be delivered straight to your device and for you to reflect on and maybe think about how it can be brought into your school and your classroom. And today's guest, I'm delighted to say I've got an old friend today who I've known for a very long time, Mark Miller. Thank you for coming on, Mark. It's nice that you've made some time. I know you're very busy. And just want to start off, if you could just give us a bit of an introduction to what your role is and what you do, because I think this is I think in lots of ways you've got lots of people's dream job. So I'd like, if you could explain a little bit about that to everyone, that'd be great.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a great job. Quite lucky to be in this position. So I'm Mark Miller, Director of Bradford Research School. So we're part of the EEF's Research School Network. And our role encompasses a lot of things, but really it's to support schools in making better use of research evidence to inform the practice. I would recommend anyone seek out the local research school because there's a range around the country. I also work within Dixon's Academies at the Centre for Growth. So part of the Central Trust team focusing on what we call professional growth across our trust for our teachers, but also all support staff and associate staff as well. I guess relevant as well is that I'm an English teacher and I've been, for a couple of decades now, which is hard to settle out. But so.
Goodness me, that is a lot. And so you've got, you do work with the EEF then, is that primarily where you're based? Is that what you do? You do lots of work with the EEF, right?
Well, through the Research School Network, so funded by the EEF and with lots of support from the EEF, and we'll do a range of things. So a day could include writing and communicating, and it could also include lots of partnership work that we've done. So we work with lots of local authorities and academy trusts and schools across the region. So yeah, so I guess not so much on the day-to-day with the EEF, but EEF kind of informs a lot of what we do, although not exclusively, but research is research, so it's not just EEF.
Interesting. I love what everything they stand for. I think it's great. I think making that kind of research really available to schools and what's going to impact, because education is a fantastic thing, but it ultimately learners have only got a very time limited amount of time in schools, and we need to respect that and make best use of that time. So I think that's why institutions like the EEF and doing what you do is so important. So before we get into the more serious stuff though, I did warn you I'd ask you this. If you weren't doing something education related, what would you be doing?
I do think this is the hardest question you're probably going to ask, and the one I spent most time thinking about. I think obviously the boring answer is, I'd love to have been a writer. Probably, still can be a writer.
That's not boring.
Yeah, but that's not, I guess I was looking back and when I was at school, a lot of my, they were higher as we did in Scotland. So a lot of those choices, I did maths, computing, business studies, I also did technological studies. So I think I was lining up to be an engineer or something. And then, because I've always loved reading, I just ended up sort of defaulting to English teaching, which I'm very glad I did. But yeah, maybe an engineer, maybe designing buildings or something.
And thankfully for everyone, you did go into teaching, because here we are now. With all the guests on the podcast, I'm not sure if people will know this, but we often have a kind of a brief chat before the recording to sort of think about the directions of travel we want to take. And it was I loved the chat that we had, because I think it was very different to other guests. And what I'd really like to start by asking you is, in terms of disciplinary literacy, what does that term mean to you? Because I think in lots of spaces at the moment, it's in vogue, and it's a fashionable term to throw around, and schools do it or don't do it or have a varying relationship with it. What does it mean to you? If you get in front of a group of staff and you're training them, how would you break that down for them, that term?
I think obviously there's a simple definition which you'll get to, but I'll give you the longer explanation. Mm-hmm. And I think probably for me, it's about starting from what it's not, or kind of more traditional ways of seeing literacy in subjects. So I think traditionally we kind of would think about the content knowledge, the knowledge of discipline, as being a separate thing to the sort of generic literacy approaches like spelling, reading that we might teach separately or might kind of exist in English classrooms more. And So one way of seeing disciplinary literacy might be that we just add those two things together. So we add the subject and we give people's literacy skills, and because of those two things combining, then they can be successful. But I think that that's somewhat limited, because I don't think it is just adding those two things together. I think it's something new, a new element in itself. So this way that the content and the literacy interact in this, in the subject discipline, that sort of uniqueness. And it's that idea that the language and the thinking and the subject discipline are inextricably linked, you're kind of intertwined. And then I'd kind of say that, you know, the language enables the thinking, the complex thinking in our subjects. The language also communicates the complex thinking in our subjects. And then it's understanding that the thinking and the language, those two things together, look a little different and sometimes massively different in every subject discipline.
I like that. I like that, because initially I was really keen to kind of, when I was initially trained on this, had a CPD session on disciplinary literacy, I sort of ran straight off and thought, right, where can I get a list of disciplinary terms for my subject? And I wanted to sort of box it off and say, well, I've done that now. But actually, it's more nuanced, of course, than that, isn't it? It's about the interplay between those two things, I think, between the content and the literacy and the thinking. I like that a lot. And we spoke a little bit before about how it's not necessarily just about, because you can run the risk, can't you, of it being just being reduced to modeling and then writing like the experts. There's actually a stage before that, isn't there? What's your point of departure in terms of how would you encourage teachers to get their learners reading and thinking like an expert?
All right. I think, that thinking part, and it's kind of twofold when we think about the thinking. I suppose one is the thinking that the teachers, we need to do about really getting to grips with the complexity of the thought processes behind, you know, whether it's reading, whether it's writing, any element there. And then for our pupils, we need to bring that to life. So there's these different stages. And even when we talk about modeling, a big part of what we're modeling isn't actually the product, is it? It's those ways of thinking. So I think in terms of what we should be doing as teachers and kind of thinking about it, well, there's a good paper. I think Timothy Shanahan's going to come up quite a lot as a really good source for some really good thinking and some research around this. And one thing that I like is where they got a bunch of experts and they did a combination of interviews and think alouds, and they just kind of talked through what they were thinking. And so there were certain kind of things that were generic that might be applicable in a range of sources. So there were things like...
So they got experts to when we say think aloud, they got experts to kind of articulate out loud their processes as they were tackling these texts in real time, right?
Yeah, and the texts that would be typical in their field, so the things they would encounter as an expert, rather than, you know, just the same text and things. And there is a generic list that they put together that's got sourcing, contextualization, corroboration, text structure, graphic elements, critique, rereading, and interest. And these were things that they saw across, you know, everyone did a version of those things. So in a sense, there was generic ways of approaching them. But then it's really interesting just the way that people kind of approach the text. And, you know, like, so when you looked at like who wrote the text, the historian was looking at the author and what they brought to the text. The mathematician kind of, the author didn't matter as long as what they had written was correct. And you know, as an English teacher, the author, depending on who you ask, is either really, really important or, you know, does not matter whatsoever. So that's quite an interesting thing to read, because it helps articulate that. But I think we can all do a version of that ourselves when we look at, you know, whether it's a textbook, and we kind of we can sit down and we can read that, and we can try and just be really, really conscious of what we're doing, where we're looking, what we're thinking. And then, you know, with reading, we sort of, you mentioned modeling writing and things, but we never read, well,
no,
we don't always model reading, and we certainly don't model reading of different, you know, approaches. So
I was in a school recently and I was delivering some CPD on a very similar topic, and I got to the point where I think it was actually after my conversation with you, I went to deliver a training later that day, and I said quite out quite brazenly. I said, you've got to think about this. It's, you know, I'm 37 now. It's over 20 years since I stood in Richmond Market, changed shoppers' habits, and then had to do an exam on, you know, urbanization and thinking like a geographer. It's been over 20 years since I did that. The reason why I went into English, because I was more comfortable with those natural thought processes around that subject. Layer on 20, 30 years with some teachers, you know, whatever, of expertise. When we read a text in our subject, there's all sorts of layered experiences that we've benefited as an expert over years from. And I think one thing we've got to be really careful of is, if nothing else, is not to assume too much. And the thinking between subjects is so nuanced, isn't it? You talk about historians, mathematicians, scientists, and then you think about a pupil having particularly a word from possibly a word poor pupil with a big literacy gap going between 5-6 subjects a day with very different modes of being. And I said to teachers in the room, you're almost literally academically built of different stuff. Different subjects are built of different stuff. There is overlap, as you said, but there's huge difference, isn't there, between the subjects?
Yeah, massively. And of course, some of those generic approaches can work. You know, there are reading strategies that will work with some proficiency and across all those different subjects. But the context matters a lot, both in terms of how those generic things are applied, but even just the meaning of a generic reading strategy changes. There's an interesting, I think it's called the situation model, but it's this idea that when we sit down and read a text, and when I say we, I guess we're talking about experts, we bring those things that everyone brings, like background knowledge. So if you don't have that, you're going to struggle, or reading proficiencies. But we also kind of ground ourselves in the text, and maybe even subconsciously what we do is we decide our goals when we read that text based on what we're seeing, and I think and then we choose the strategies to meet those goals, and depending on the text and the context, those will change. But we need to know what we're achieving with a certain text.
Yeah,
we need the strategies.
I think that's really interesting. So I was, again, in a CPD session to lead up to this. I did some screenshots of different exam papers from different subjects. And in one of the business studies one, it was a case study on Greggs. And it was all about vegan sausage rolls. And actually, do you know something? It gave me nightmares, like going back to this idea of having to look at a business case study and then being able to comment analytically on it. It's shocking for me. I hated it. It was so difficult, and it was largely, I mean, I'll blame my teacher, but it was, you know, I never kind of ever got it broken down for me, you know, like a text model or something to be able to isolate the facts I needed in order to be able to comment with real accuracy on the Greggs, whatever it was, model that I was being asked to comment on. Whereas give me a passage of the opening of Mice and Men, I can unpick the nuance. I just loved it. I was completely, you know, and I think you're right that you do. And I think sometimes when you talk about forming those goals, it's not difficult to say that students naturally form relationships with different subjects and different text types because they find forming those goals easier naturally in some subjects than others. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I guess as two English teachers, it's a bit easier, isn't it, for us to make sense of that, where, you know, the text, we're studying it for a very clear goal. It's almost like, but in other subjects, I think we've got to be clear as well that, you know, lots of teachers are experts in this, and, you know, if we bring on teachers in other subjects, they will talk about how they manage the text within their subject.
When I did my math GCSE, I remember very deliberately, and some of those other more factually based subjects in that sense, you get a question on proportions or fractions or whatever, and you're reading it and you think, oh yeah, this is the question, but it's really testing my ability to do this. And it's interesting that there's almost two separate things, whereas with English you can just in lots of ways immerse yourself completely in the text, but then literature, even within English, is slightly different again, because an essay is a very distinct skill compared to, say, an English language piece of analysis. So I guess to kind of bring this round a bit, what we are looking at is we're looking at trying to make explicit to our learners the goals that they should have when they sit down in the discipline. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's it. That's a good way of putting it. And just when thinking about maths questions as well, that I think obviously there is a goal, i.e., you know, people need to answer the question. But actually, it's that idea, you know, in mathematics where one of the things that's really hard is, like you say, choosing the best strategy to answer the maths question. And that is, you know, in the worded problems, that is your goal of the reading to start off with. What type of question is this? And and I've seen really great practice. I recently shared some examples from Don Valley Academy. So Delta School, they're now a research school, another popular research school. Right. But and they just showed how they explicitly modelled how you unpick a maths question. And there's something there about when, for maths as a subject, for example, say this as an English teacher, but this idea that often we'll practice something and we know which questions we're answering because that's what we're practicing in that lesson. So obviously interleaving these problem types can really help with that, but explicitly teaching these slightly out of that practice context. So if you look at a worded question after you've just practiced all the skills for that, then that reading goal is kind of taken care of because they don't have to think which problem it is. So, you know, explicit modeling of how to work out, you know, what the questions, you know, that those count as text types as much as, you know, Macbeth or anything.
There's a cognitive load reflection going on here, isn't there, as well, isn't there? And how cognitive load, and we might understand that links with different question types. I mean, here's an example again. I'll go back to my safety zone of English. I often teach pupils the importance of writing a hypothesis statement before they do an essay. But actually, it's about the thinking about the hypothesis statement that's really important, because it tidies their thinking up about how they're going to then have a coherent reflection on the text overall. Whereas when it comes to maths, for example, that cognitive load might be about, for example, automating the process around how to tackle that question, what the method is. So when you're getting your hands dirty with a question and unpicking what all the words say and all that sort of stuff, actually there's less strain going on because you find doing the sum itself, the mathematics itself, more automatic. So it's, I think there's a piece here in terms of reading and helping pupils to minimize their cognitive load when it comes to question types and things like that.
Yeah, and any kind of, I mean, that's what, whenever we talk about, you know, reading strategies, it's a little bit like that, isn't it? It's an automatic routine. And, you know, we all have these, you know, when we pick up any, you know, anything in our daily life to read, and we sort of automatically choose these strategies. It's just, yeah, again, when we get into the subject, I think you're right, this idea about, if we don't have these strategies, then we're always trying to work it out as we go along. So the more ways of thinking and ways of doing in our subjects that we have, the more we can focus on those difficult parts, the really hard parts, which is the content and the thinking.
I think some of it comes down to just really almost, not for everyone, but for some learners, actually to an extent for all learners, but to differing degrees, really kind of straightforward instructions about, for example, again, looking at an essay, I always said to my pupils, read the question and circle the keyword. Then have a think about what your idea is about that keyword, and then go to the extract, for example, and find how that extract links to the rest of the text. And even for some, it's just a case of doing those three things. For others, it's a case of, well, we're unpicking these three steps because we're doing it in this way. We're doing it like the expert. So I guess part of the trick for teachers, that sort of artisanal, that sort of expert in the room bit, is you make the thinking really clear, whether it's a case of following in steps or whether it's a case of sharing the rationale for those steps. But it's about helping pupils become expert readers, whatever that means for them in your subject.
Yeah. And that process comes from codifying what expert readers do, which is harder for us because we're the experts. We don't often do those steps. And then it's about explicitly teaching these approaches but also I guess and modeling is a big part of that. But it's also that bit about explicitly teaching, almost that moment where we choose a strategy, that moment where we, and that's the bit we have to articulate. And I think it's easier to do that with writing, I think, and more common to do it with writing than reading. And I think, we've gone on about English quite a lot, but I guess what we're doing as two experts is we could really try to unpick that and build off our own ideas around
I think I might say in this conversation, Mark, we'll say 1.5 experts.
Fair enough. Which are we three? Let's be 3/4 of experts each.
Responsible.
But I guess what I'm saying is you could put two math teachers are better to talk about this than we are. And once you get those experts in the room, you do start to, it works really well. And I think that's, I know you'll ask this officially later, but that's one of the things we can do, just get teachers talking about this, because once we start to do it, we do start to see bring these things to life a little bit. And often that's all we need. It's not a big whole school initiative. It's not a massive change. It's just a little opportunity, a little thing built in just before we start, before we start engage with any text, we take 5 minutes to situate ourselves as experts, right? Is there anything we need to teach? This geography textbook that we're going to use today, do we need to teach pupils about how to navigate their way through a textbook, how to navigate sections when they answer the questions at the end? Do they know that they'll be in chronological order? Do they know what the bits in bold mean? Do they know how to, deal with the text? So all these different things. And if we just spend 5 minutes doing that, I think it means that we will either explicitly teach some things or we'll just be ready when we come to ask pupils to, to tackle the text.
I just had a really interesting conversation with a colleague at Bedrock who's at the moment working on the reading test and the results and how we're going to share those with colleagues when people sit the test. And she just wanted my view on it as someone who's been a head of department looking at data. And you know what she did? It was quite uncomfortable, actually. She just showed me a range of graphs that could show reading data. And she literally just put it on screen and said, "Tell me what you see. What do you see?" And it was really hard for me because I'm used to doing things in a very comfortable place in terms of data in my own office. But actually having someone come along and say, "What does this look like? What does this look like?" And I thought it was a really, because she'd gone away and visualized some of the things I'd asked her to think about and maybe suggested to think about for the reading test. But then actually it was really nice that she came back to me and said, this is what I was thinking, this is, as the data expert, this is how it was presented. But then she wanted me to see my novice thinking of it when I looked at those graphs, and it was really nice. I thought that was a really nice thing for her to do. And I think when you're trying to teach or find information out about where a learner is, I think sharing the thinking, sharing whatever that looks like in your domain is a really nice thing to do. And actually, I think it's more interesting, for learners to come across a more distinct variety of thinking. And I feel really passionately about this. I think whether a pupil takes a subject to year 11 or to year 9 or whatever it is, I think it's our job in schools, it's the thing, is to give them as many meaningful experiences of different disciplines as possible, because if they don't have meaningful experiences, they're going to have much less opportunity to choose what they like in their lives, what chimes with them the most, what it is that they're meant to do, with their lives. So I think that's a really important thing that you're pulling apart there about the distinction between reading and writing. I found that really interesting, which is why I wanted to ask about it today. So, drilling down even further then, if you look at this on a classroom level, and you've worked with teachers a lot over the last few years, what's your advice to, for a teacher listening to this, what would your advice be about how to go and actualize and actually make this happen in your classroom? And it could be subject specific or it might not be subject specific. What advice would you give to colleagues?
Well, I do think we've touched upon some of it, which is, literally just have this lens and ask those conversations around, what are the unique ways of thinking in my subject and how are those unique ways of thinking particularly communicated? We've talked a lot about reading in particular, but we could also be talking about vocabulary, text types. We could talk about even just sentence level stuff as well. So I think, as always, implementation is key. So I wouldn't ever recommend we do a million things. Yeah. I think you know, a really good place to start would just be look at the text in my subject, kind of identify them, read it like an expert, practice through that, then think, what's it like if you're not the expert, if you're a novice approaching this, and kind of bridge that gap by making, by teaching and making implicit explicit. I think it's worth starting with places, and I also, because we can do this in isolation as individual teachers, there'll also, I guess, be leaders of literacy thinking about this as well. And I think that same message around starting small is really important, that the initiative, you know, that we've all seen in literacy in particular does seem to happen. So I think, you know, vocabulary is another really simple place to start. I think, like, one thing I did just when I was thinking about this, I think for webinar, and I was looking at other subjects, just trying to push myself out of the English comfort zone. And I looked at music glossaries at Key Stage 2. And I just set myself a challenge of, okay, let's look for the patterns. So as a really simple thing that, you know, let's look for the patterns in the language in our subjects. And again, really nerdy, but I just find it really interesting with the music. So just in one Key Stage 2 glossary, we got these sort of capitalized genres of music. So blues, jazz, neo-soul came across. So all of these are both definitions, if you like. They mean thing, but they mean way more than the definitions. They've got all sorts of cultural aspects. They've got origins. They've got the way that those genres change or join others. All these Latin terms, so improvised, tempo, ostinato, and again, all really, really interesting to unpack. And they tell you not just, they give us so much, not just about the language of music, but, you know, why Latinate words in music, and where did these originate? Why are they synonymous? And then there was a couple of French words in there, and I couldn't quite get an answer where they came from. But I guess if I was a music teacher and I was with other music teachers, that's a really rich conversation. And again, what that's doing is it's not only looking at the language of the subject, and it's not only building vocabulary, which is always great, but it's also the subject itself. So it's trying to find those ways in. I think what else I think is really rich, and there's some decent evidence around, is focusing on sentences, sentence combining, because one of the, you know, essentially that's all writing is, really. It's combining units of thought, ideas into these sentences, and the way we create those sentences conveys meaning. So I think a really fruitful thing to do is just work out the thinking in your subject, and then work out ways to convey that in sentences, and then practice, you know, I would definitely practice that by combining sentences and things like that. So I think thinking about more practical ways as well, there's a good list from the EEF. This is in the Improving Literacy in Secondary School Guidance Report. So they've got, I mean, that's a really good way to see disciplinary literacy as well. You know, you could probably rename that Disciplinary Literacy Guidance Report, I think. So I thoroughly recommend that. But they've got four questions. So I'll just say those. So they say, you know, what is unique about your subject discipline in terms of reading, writing, speaking, and listening? What's common with other subject disciplines? How do members of this subject discipline use language on a daily basis? So how do the experts, if you like? Are there any typical literacy misconceptions held by students? For example, how to write an effective science report. And then the last one, are there words and phrases used typically or uniquely in the subject discipline? And that could prompt a lot of reflection. Oh, you know, lots and lots of department meetings and reflections there. And again, one of the biggest challenges I think here is that it's really hard to move from the generic to the specific. It's really hard to do this as a whole school, because you have to start with the generic, and then you just have to say, right, off you go and discover. And I guess, you know, different subject networks will have their own resources you could probably tap into and things, but it is a thing that you have to push back on the teachers to think, rather than say, here's the 10 things you all have to do.
And we're sort of moving now into the territory of the final question I want to ask you about, which is kind of, how do you change thinking in schools? And here, I really like Tom Sherrington's metaphor of the learning rainforest, the idea that, you know, every subject needs to be given the time and the space to come up with these narratives and these understandings of their subjects. Because actually, I bet that after 5 years of leading English in my school, I bet the narrative around the what that I crafted around and my colleagues crafted around the subject of English would be different to how maybe you would have done it over 5 years, or how other colleagues would have done it, and that's fine, because it's and what you know we have a part of our platform's called Bedrock Mapper, and there's over 37,000 words in there that colleagues can lean on and think about. But Mapper's really powerful, but it's only as impactful as the quality of conversation that underpins it. It has to be about having the space and the time for colleagues to be able to kind of talk about those things. So you're talking about, you know, roots of words in music. I often, you know, and it, you know, there's probably more successful English teachers than me that have done it, that done different things in their subjects. But I often talk about the idea that in creative writing, for example, that one of the words in the top band of the mark scheme is compelling. Com means with, pel means move with. That means you're trying to get your audience to move with you. You're not going to get an audience to move with you if you talk about blood-sucking zombies chasing you through a forest with killer clowns everywhere. It's not compelling. It's not exciting, because you're never going to be able to do that sort of thing justice. If it's about a child lost in a marketplace looking at a photo of their parents, that's much more compelling and it's much more interesting, I think. And it's about crafting those kind of tiny narratives on the subject level that really bring your subject to life, isn't it? That's the idea about changing thinking in schools.
Yeah, and these will arise sometimes consciously, and sometimes, you know, you might just have put that into an etymological dictionary, or you might have known all those root words, those word parts. But yeah, so I think there is a little bit about that, finding those little narratives. And that's a really great example, because it is about learning a word. It's also about hitting a mark scheme. But there's something about that loop, breaking down that word that helps make their writing better. And also, by breaking down a word, you're showing them that we break down words, that we can learn a lot from breaking down words, and they can take that into maybe science, you know. And again, how long have we got on this recording? But, you know, just how we spend ages talking about words. So in science, we could probably do a similar thing, maybe mathematics as well.
Absolutely.
In history, and you've got, you know, things like the Dark Ages and the Renaissance, and these are all slightly more metaphorical. You can't break those, you know, you can't literally break down those things and get an answer. So there's, you know, even through vocabulary. And I think we should encourage our teachers. So this is a good example of sort of word consciousness, this idea, just this playfulness with language. And as a simple way that schools can do it is just, you know, what are two or three words in the week that are interesting for you as a you know, geography teacher, interesting for you in your art lessons, that are worth just playing around with. And, you know, I think these are really rich opportunities. And I think a lot of disciplinary literacy doesn't have to be, you know, you mentioned kind of space and time, and I think we do need to encourage that. But let's be honest, it's competing with a million other demands. So trying to find ways that we can change a little tweak in a mindset that means that it's those opportunities and our lessons. I think those are really important.
And I love asking that question, not what can I do for literacy, but what literacy can do for me. It's probably a bit of a cliche now, but I love it, because you look at maths, you know, algebra means the reunion of broken parts. I'm really confident that if someone had said that to me when I was learning algebra at school, it wouldn't have done any harm. At least it would have helped me to understand what algebra was about, rather than freaking me out about, oh my God, letters and numbers, that doesn't work, that's mad. Fracture, fraction, break. And I just think those things about how literature can serve your needs in the classroom, we know. I mean, science, as a linguist, I studied this at uni, science and the sciences and all of those things, that, you know, we're littered with Greek and Latin words, because those civilizations were so much more advanced than we were, that we borrowed, we've influxed all those words into our language. So, and you can start to predict, you know, biology, you know, biosphere, all those word roots that start to just enrich and enliven the conversation within the discourse of your subject. And I think you're right. It's not about, I mean, I think it's ideal if you can create space for it, but actually, if you can just tweak the direction, and it's not, it's no more than spending 20 seconds Googling what's the root word of such and such, and then just giving you an interesting way in with a concept.
Yeah, definitely. And it's such a tiny little thing. And I think this idea that I just come back to something else you said there about it's not harmful to do this. So you might, there's an argument there that, you know, the definitions of some words are merely just interesting, right? But they're not going to take that much time. And in doing that little interesting part, then you're showing that we can pick words. So that's definitely not harmful at all. And I think, I guess where we might see the harm in anything like this is whenever you have an approach and that takes time, you're taken away from something else. And I think that idea around literacy. So we've mentioned before, like literacy initiatives, and I think, you know, countless literacy training ones where people get asked, who's a teacher of literacy, and they all be hands up, and that, you know, those kind of things that we see as cliched. But part of that thing is we've got to convince people, or at least show people, that it's not this big extra thing. And actually, yes, it is probably, you know, writing is going to fall to the English teacher a lot of the time. We're going to teach writing. That's really important. We're going to explicitly teach reading maybe a bit more. But that actually, if you can spend a bit more time in your subject, then it's enhancing the subject. And it's not this big initiative that's been passed down. And I think, you know, truthfully as well, let's not pretend we're inventing something brand new here, because, you know, there are great teachers
in lots of
subjects that are doing this already. So a lot of the time it will be shining a light on what's already going on in some of those schools where, you know, these things will be taken. You know, I've seen maths teachers modelling literacy, you know, as well as any English teacher. So,
I think that's a really important point. You can very easily go into a school and say, do you know what disciplinary literacy means? And no one puts their hand up. But then you go and walk around that school that day, and there'll be some really, really fantastic teachers in every school where you see it happening. And even for those teachers who might not have put their hand up in the morning but were doing it, it's about maybe even for them, for the expert, getting them to make clear, you know, in their own heads what they're doing and why it's successful. My own journey as a teacher, I know this isn't the be all and end all, but my outcomes for the learners that I taught got massively better once I cleared up my own thinking about the structure of an essay, what analysis really meant, and how to commit, you know, analysis meaning to loosen or to untie. You know, you can tell structure, you know, putting things together, that type of thing. When I tidied up these concepts myself, not through a literacy initiative, but because I was interested in these aspects of my subject, my teaching improved massively. At least I think it did. It certainly felt like it did. And I think you're right. It's not necessarily about the label then coming in and everyone doing what you tell them to do. It's more about an appreciation of the nuance of each subject and teachers in their own classrooms and their own minds celebrating the brilliance of what they do.
Yeah, exactly. And not, you know, just trying to make it align and complement what's going on. And, you know, I do you know, there's been enough initiatives that kind of don't do that. I think what was another one I was looking at recently, like the Freya model? So that's that.
Yeah. I was hoping we'd touch on this. Let's make this our last thing, because I was hoping this is the good thing to finish on. I love this question. I think this is a really good line of thinking of yours.
Oh.
No pressure. Off we go.
Well, I've probably stolen any good ideas I was kissed, but so I think the Freya model is a really good example of the kind of thing that is sort of good, but can become just quite restrictive and a bad example of the literacy initiative, if you like. So just for listeners who don't know, the Freya model, I think originally conceived by Dorothy Freya Earle. I've never found the original where it became a grid. But it's this idea, you've got a word in the centre, you've got boxes for definition, characteristics, examples and non-examples. And that's the one that you'll see most often, the one I've seen. I think it is certainly in one of the guidance reports, but I can't remember which one. And I've seen that used quite a lot and often used really, really well. And I think that's fine. But if we restrict it just to those four boxes, then we're saying these are the four ways you must think about words. And the whole reason the Freya model exists is to get that idea about a deep, deep, meaningful processing of a word. So if our goal is to understand the concept and to be able to use it, you know, we need that. And so we should ask really, is it, you know, do we want those four things? You know, should we change them? And I think we definitely can in different subjects. So again, it's like, let's say in history, you put a history concept or a word in there. Is it really definition, characteristics, examples of non-examples? Well, sometimes it doesn't make sense, because if you put Industrial Revolution, yeah, you can maybe put some examples, but it is what it is. So what you might do is you might do connotations, or you might do things that it led to, consequences, let's say, and things that led up to it. And every historical concept has got those things.
Even in English, you know, you're looking at non-examples, you can change the language there to characters not like this, texts not like this. You know, you don't have to lift the Freire model as you've seen it in when you put Freire model into Google Image and use that. The whole point, as you say, is about exploring something from different angles, right?
Exactly. And so, and this is where there's a danger if we really get excited about disciplinary literacy, which I think we should, there's a danger here. What's the big thing we can do? Freire model fits into that, or any kind of artifact or concrete thing you can do. And it's just about saying, okay, we'll take it this far. Now, you know, so it might be that you as a school decide that we're going to roll with that because we want to develop rich vocabulary and we want to have a consistent method. And I think there's arguments for all of those things in schools.
Yeah.
But then what we then want to say is, as the subject specialist, how would you change that? What would make it better? What would make it stick better? And what would give it more utility? So it's not just about knowing the word, it's being able to use that in a range of contexts. So, and again, I think, but we could say that for any, like we picked on the Freire model because I think it's quite, feels like a lot of schools are using it, but you could pick anything and then just say, right, well, what does this look like? And that's obviously not just, you know, you could get into all sorts of things like, you know, questioning and classroom routines and explanations.
Yeah, of course.
These are all going to have a disciplinary lens as much as literacy will. And so I think it's a good mindset to go, well, what does it look like?
There's that danger of, same with schools, there's that danger of, because you're doing everything at such massive scale, there's that danger of reductionism, isn't there? There's that danger that everything becomes overly simplified so we can say we've done it. And that's not inherently an evil thing. It's just something to be mindful of, isn't it? It's something to be careful about when it comes to this type of thing. That's about us. That's 45 minutes. That's perfect timing. Thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. And I know that there'll be lots of people listening to this who'll be thanking you for your ideas and your wisdom here, Mark. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Andy.